This is Molly Smith introducing our annual Bringing America Back to Life speaker series. At this annual event, we invite those on the front lines of the pro-life and family movement to come together for a convention dedicated to exploring the full spectrum of issues and challenges that confront us as we continue to fight for the sanctity of human life, to protect our God-given family structure. We trust you will be edified and encouraged as you listen to our fine roster of speakers who by their articulate, thoughtful, expert presentations eloquently defend the right to life. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Abby Johnson. She is the founder of And Then There Were None, a ministry designed to assist abortion clinic workers out of the industry. Abby has always had a fierce determination to help women in need. It was this desire that both led Abby to a career with Planned Parenthood, our nation's largest abortion provider, and caused her to flee the organization and become an outspoken advocate for the pro-life movement. Everything changed on September 26, 2009, when Abby was asked to assist with an ultrasound-guided abortion. She watched in horror as a 13-week-old baby fought and ultimately lost its life at the hands of an abortionist. Desperate and confused, Abby sought help from the local pro-life groups. She swore that she would begin to advocate for life in the womb and expose abortion for what it truly is. To date, this ministry has helped hundreds of workers leave the abortion industry. Her topic? And then there were none.
Well, I am from Texas, so howdy. It's good to be here with y'all. I am pregnant. I didn't just eat too much fish. I live in Austin with my husband, Doug, and we have 5 kids. We have a daughter who's 10, and we have 4 boys who are 1, 2, 3, and 4. Yeah, and I am pregnant with twin girls. So, yeah, we became pro-life and we meant it. So anyway, my first 2 sons are 10 and a half months apart, but I say they're 11 months apart just so that people think we have self-control. My second 2 sons are 13 months apart, and my last 2 sons are 6 months apart, and I move fast, but not quite that fast. Our youngest son was gifted to us through adoption. So, funny story. Is it funny now? One of those stories. So I'm in this Facebook group of about 30 women, and we're all really good friends. And one of them is a sign language interpreter. And she interprets for a deaf community in her church in Maryland. And she had become friends with a woman that she interpreted for and had found out that this woman was married, and she had 3 children, and she was pregnant with her 4th. Her 4th had been conceived through a very violent assault, not her husband. And she became pregnant, and she went to many people in her church and many of her friends and family and told them about the situation. And they told her, well, this is the one time that abortion is acceptable. And she very courageously said, well, it's either a baby all of the time or it's a baby none of the time. And she moved forward with an adoption plan for him. And about 2 weeks before her due date, the family emailed her and said, we've been thinking about it and we've decided that since there's a possibility that your child could also be deaf, we don't want him. Because, you know, you always know what you're going to get when you have your own biological children. Okay, a little slow. Okay, so then another family was called, but they weren't interested because the baby was biracial and they were white and they wanted a white baby that looked like them. And so my friend posts in this Facebook group, hey, you know, please pray for this situation. And if anyone knows anyone who would be interested in adopting this baby, let me know. I was in Atlanta, speaking for a pregnancy center event. And I saw this pop up on my phone and I looked at it and I'm not really sure why I did it, but I wrote, "We will." And my friend immediately called me and she said, "Are you crazy?" Because Carter, our youngest son at the time, was only 6 months old. And I said, "Yeah, because we have so many babies right now in our house. Throwing another one in is really not a big deal. And I haven't slept in like 3 years. So why not?" So she said, "Okay, well, I'm going to call and let this woman know." And I said, "Great, do that." So I hung up the phone and I thought, huh, I should call my husband. What I really thought was, can I just shoot him a text? But I thought I should call. So I called him and he was sort of mad. I don't know. Mad's not the right word. He was more panicky because, see, my husband is a stay-at-home dad. So this actually affects him more than me. Some women bring home a new pair of shoes. I bring home a baby. So anyway, 2 weeks later, our son was born and we were there and we were trying to decide what to name him. And we knew we wanted to name him a name that started with the letter J because his mother's name, her name starts with J, and her three other children, their names start with J. So we wanted to honor her in that way. And so we're Catholic. We've been converts for 5 years. And I didn't have a whole lot to do with it. So we like to name our kids a saint name and a family name. And so we had the family name. And so we were trying to find a saint name. And I mean, I'm sort of new, you know, so I don't know a lot of saints. So I went online to like saints.com or something. And I clicked on the letter J, and I went down the list, and no one was really sticking out to me. I got to the end, and I saw St. Jude. And for those of you that maybe don't know, St. Jude is a patron saint of impossible or desperate causes. And I thought, yeah, that's the perfect name for this little boy, because there had to be times that his mother felt like this was a very impossible situation. Going to her friends and family, going to people in her church, and having her son be rejected by them because of how he was conceived. And then having a family reject him because of a possible hearing deficit. And then because of his ethnicity. There had to be times where she felt like this was impossible. But every day, she continued to choose life for him. And I think about Jude. I think about his life. I recognize truly what a miracle it is that he's with us. Because to be perfectly honest, he was a target by both sides. He was a target by the abortion lobby because of his ethnicity. Because we know that Planned Parenthood was founded for the sole purpose of eliminating the minority population, particularly the African American population. And so he was targeted there, but friends, he was also targeted by our pro-life movement because of how he was conceived, because of so many people that continue to make the exception for these innocent babies. And so I do recognize what a miracle it is that he's here. But honestly, when I look at the abortion rate in our country, 1 in 3 women having abortions, I realize that every child that makes it to birth in this country is a miracle. I would love to tell you I've always stood up here and defended life, but you know that's not true. I worked for Planned Parenthood for 8 years. I was a clinic director for their third largest affiliate in the country. It's out of Houston. We were building at the time, it's now operational, the largest abortion facility in the Western Hemisphere. It's off the Gulf Freeway in Houston. It's 78,000 square feet. It is 7 stories tall. The third floor was built in order to abort babies through the sixth month of pregnancy. And we had the capacity to abort 75 babies every day, 6 days a week. And that was my life. I would like to tell you that I had all of this angst about what I did for Planned Parenthood, but I didn't. I loved my job. I believed that I was doing the right thing. I believed that I was helping women. I got involved with Planned Parenthood as a college kid. I went to Texas A&M University. Yep, not one fan. Okay, and you could have faked it. It's all right. It's all right. I don't want the pity. It's too late. Ugh. Well, I'm sorry about Johnny Manziel. Okay, so oh yeah, I forgot. Sorry. Anyway, so I was at school there, and I met a woman with Planned Parenthood, and she began giving me all of their talking points, and I grew up in a Christian home. My parents, I remember saying I was pro-life. I remember saying that in high school, but I was just sort of regurgitating whatever my parents said. I didn't grow up in a church that spoke out about abortion. I don't ever remember hearing about abortion from the pulpit my entire life. And so, So we weren't a family that sat around the dinner table and discussed the ins and outs of abortion or what it was to be pro-life or pro-choice. Being pro-life was something that we said, but it wasn't how we lived. And so, when I went to college and heard about Planned Parenthood, I don't know that I'd ever heard the name Planned Parenthood before. And so she started giving me all the talking points, you know them. Without Planned Parenthood, low-income women would have nowhere else to go for health care, and how, you know, without access to safe and legal abortion, women are going to be just falling out, dying all over the place from these back alley abortions, and pro-lifers, they're good people, but they're just sort of misguided, you guys, and she said that, you know, you guys just don't see the big picture. You know, these pro-lifers are trying to take away our rights to do with our bodies what we will. And then what are they going to go for next? And they're going to tell us, you know, women can't vote, you know, and then what? Then they're going to say, you know, women aren't allowed to wear pants. And I thought, well, I like pants. So I signed up immediately. And I tell people, it's what I didn't know about the abortion industry. It's what I didn't know about Planned Parenthood. That's what led me in their doors. It was my pure ignorance. When she told me that Planned Parenthood is the only place women can go for health care, I didn't know that was just a blatant lie. There are currently about 650 Planned Parenthood clinics across the country. There are 13,000 federally qualified health centers, rural public health centers, hospital health systems, and county health departments that provide far more comprehensive care to women and their families. That 13,000 doesn't include the over 3,000 pregnancy medical centers that take women in and provide some services for them. It also doesn't include the tens of thousands of private practice physicians that accept government subsidy programs like Medicaid. So we're talking about tens of thousands of providers compared to 650, but Planned Parenthood is the only place that women can go. It's a lie, but they've said it so much that people believe it is the truth. That's what happens. You say a lie enough, and people begin to believe it is true. And this whole thing about back alley abortions is so ridiculous. You know, women are no safer now inside of safe and legal abortion clinics than they were in these supposed back alley clinics. Because in the end, abortion can never be safe. In order for an abortion to be successful, an innocent human being must die. It can never be safe. It's what I didn't know. And I submit to you tonight that I believe it's what the majority of women do not know in our society that leads them in the doors of these clinics. It's what they don't know about their bodies. It's what they don't know about their fertility. It's what they don't know about their unborn child. It's what they don't know about abortion. And friends, it's what they don't know about Jesus Christ. That's what leads them inside of these clinics. And people ask me all the time, you know, Abby, how is it that you went from, you know, being this good Christian kid to being a person who ran an abortion clinic? You know, how is it that you went from being this good kid? I was a pretty good kid. I didn't do very many things wrong that my parents found out about. You know, how is it that you went from being that kid to being a person who laid on an abortion clinic table, not once, but twice, to take the lives of my own children by abortion? Like, Abby, how did that happen? And I don't really have just a striking silver bullet sort of answer for you tonight, except to say that it happened just a little bit at a time. Because that's the way that sin works in our lives. It's just one little lie at a time, one little justification at a time. And it can turn you into somebody that you don't even recognize. But while I know that the enemy has to sneak around to do his dirty work, I know that when God wants to change your life, he is bold. And it can happen like that. And that's what happened to me in the fall of 2009. 2009 had been an interesting year for me. In April of that year, I was awarded Planned Parenthood's Employee of the Year Award. I know you're all very proud of me. You can hold your applause. I was pretty proud of myself. I had just come off of working Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. I know you're fans. It's all right. I got to go to the national gala, Planned Parenthood's national gala. There were about 3,500 people there. We raised about $10 million, similar to what we will raise here tonight. And I got to sit and have dinner with Hillary Clinton, and it was very intimate, me, Hillary, and 10 Secret Servicemen. And I watched her take the stage to accept Planned Parenthood's most distinguished award, their most honored award that they give out, called the Margaret Sanger Circle Award. So every year, Planned Parenthood continues to celebrate their racist roots by giving out an award in their founder, Margaret Sanger's name. And I watched her take the stage, and then she gave a speech. I don't remember what she said. I'm sure it was riveting. But I remember thinking in April of 2009, this is as good as it's going to get for me. This is the best. It's never going to get better than this. In August of that year, I had a meeting with my supervisor, and I was instructed that we were to double our abortion quota, the amount of abortions that we had to sell to women coming into our clinic. And that was bothersome for me because I really believed that at Planned Parenthood, our goal was to reduce the number of abortions. That's what we said. That's what I said to the media. That's what I said to my friends and family and anyone who asked. We're not about selling abortion. That's ridiculous. We're about prevention. We're about reducing the need for abortion. But there it was in paper. I was to double my abortion quota. And I said something out loud to my boss. And I said, this must be a mistake. And she started laughing at me. And she said, Abby, why would we want to reduce our abortion numbers? That's how we make our money. I don't think that's any surprise to you guys. But for me, somehow I had this disconnect in my mind. I don't know how it happens, except sometimes sin can literally blind you to what's right in front of your face. I remember taking, I mean, I was the director. I remember taking bank bags, 4, 5, 6 bank bags stuffed full of $25,000 to $30,000 in cash on successful abortion days. Of course it was about money. But somehow I just didn't see it. About a month later, we had a visiting physician come in from out of town, and he owned his own private practice abortion facility. And he explained to me that I don't think this is going to be surprising to you, but it's actually safer for the patient if the doctor can see what he's doing while he's performing surgery. And I had never really thought about it before, but our abortion procedures were performed in a blind manner. So the physician came in and he began the procedure, and he inserted a cannula, a suction tube, into the woman's uterus, and he just blindly poked around inside the woman's uterus until he thought he had enough blood and tissue in a glass jar. That glass jar went into a lab called the POC lab. POC stands for what? Products of conception. What's that? That's the baby, but you can't say baby inside of an abortion clinic. So we said POC or POC, or if the staff was feeling funny, we would say it stood for parts of children. And inside the POC lab, there was a POC technician, and their job was to take everything that was in that glass jar, dump it into a glass baking dish, and reassemble the parts of the baby. Now, why did we do that? Because if we left an arm or a foot or the spine or the head inside the woman's uterus, she could develop a very serious infection that could be fatal to her. And after all of the parts have been accounted for, the POC technician would take everything, bundle it up into a red biohazard Ziploc sort of bag, and put it into a freezer that we jokingly called the nursery. And once a week, a company like Stericycle would come and pick up all the little red bags of babies, take them to their facility where they are incinerated. And that's how abortion takes place in this country almost 3,000 times a day. And that was the only way that I knew abortion to be performed, because I had only worked at Planned Parenthood clinics. So when this doctor was explaining to me that it was safer if he used an ultrasound during the actual abortion procedure so he could see inside the woman's uterus as he's performing surgery, that made sense to me. So I went back to my supervisor and I said, if this is safer, why isn't this something that we're making our standard of care? I mean, we say we care about patient safety, so if this is safer, why aren't we doing that? And she said, well, it is safer, but she said, using ultrasound guidance during the actual abortion procedure takes about an extra 3 minutes of time. And our goal inside of Planned Parenthood was to have a woman on the table, off the table, abortion completed in 5 minutes. So to add on an extra 3 minutes of time whenever you're trying to perform, I don't know, 35 to 50 abortions a day, it's simply not something that we were able to do. Time is money. So I accepted that answer. This doctor told me that if the right patient presented and there was enough time, he would show me what this type of procedure looked like. That time did come. I was called into the room to assist. My job during the abortion was to hold the ultrasound probe in place so the doctor could, in his words, visualize his target. We did the measurement. We found that the baby was 13 weeks along. As you know, at 13 weeks, everything's formed. Arms, legs, fingers, toes, heartbeat, brain waves, all the internal organs. And I stood there and I reminded myself that no matter what I saw on this screen, this baby, POC, feet, whatever we want to call it, was not going to feel anything. I knew that because Planned Parenthood sent me a memo about it. It was entitled Answers to Tough Questions. Most frequently asked question I got from women coming into our center was, will my baby feel this? I don't know. I guess we all do it. Somehow we have equated humanity to the presence or absence of pain. I mean, we've even done it in pro-life legislation. Pain is the reason that we want to ban some abortions, not the innate humanity and dignity of the child. So I stood there, I watched as the cannula, the suction tube, the suction wasn't yet turned on. I watched that go into the woman's uterus. And I saw as it got closer and closer to the side of this baby, and when it touched his side, he jumped. And he began flailing his arms and legs as if he was trying to move away from the abortion instrument. But there was nowhere for him to go. The doctor asked the technician to turn on the suction machine, and he said, "Beam me up, Scotty." And I think people make the assumption that what I saw next was the worst part, that seeing a child become dismembered in his mother's womb would be the worst part. And that was bad, but I knew that was going to happen. That wasn't the worst part. The worst part was that when I had the opportunity to do something, I just stood there. I did nothing. I mean, I remember having the desire to sit this woman up and to say, look at your baby. Stop them. I remember wanting to do that, but I didn't. I just stood there and I watched. And just a few seconds later, the screen was black, and I knew that that meant that the abortion had been successful. And I went back to my office, and I didn't know where to turn. I didn't know what to do. I felt angry. I felt confused. I felt like a liar. And I began to pray, really, for the first time in 8 years. And for 8 years of my life, there had been people standing outside of my facility praying. And I knew they were out there primarily to pray for the women going in, but I knew they were there to pray for me, too. They told me they were. And so I began to pray, and I was looking out my window, and I could see these two women standing out there, and I began to ask God for some sort of direction. And I felt like he was telling me to go to them, to this pro-life group. And I thought, no, give me somebody else. But I felt like that was where I needed to go. So I ran out the back door. I got in my car. I could have walked to their office because it was conveniently located next door. But I thought that would look suspicious, so I got in my car and drove the 50 yards, and I parked in their parking lot, and I got out of the car, and I walked in their door, and I sat on their couch, and I didn't know what to say. I'm sorry? I mean, that didn't seem like enough. I'm sorry. Sorry. I have helped participate in 20,000 deaths. Sorry. But in the end, sitting on that couch, I realized that there was absolutely nothing I could ever do to make up for what I had done. But because of the amazing and honestly scandalous mercy of Christ, I didn't have to. And I decided I was going to go ahead and resign, not to worry. I gave him a good 5 minutes notice. And I was leaving. I was taking my last load of stuff to my car. And the Coalition for Life, the pro-life group, they had sent a young man over to the sidewalk just to make sure I was able to leave without incident. His name was Bobby. And I walked out and I waved at Bobby and I told him I would be at their office the next day. He said, okay. I got in my car and I pulled out of that parking lot for the last time and I took a left. And Bobby didn't know I was watching him or I could see him or anything, but I remember looking in my rearview mirror and I saw him. He just put his arms in the air and he fell to his knees. Because there had to be times where they looked at me and they said, she's never going to leave. It's never going to happen. God, why do you have us praying for this woman? She's mean to us. She mocks us. I was not the friendly abortion clinic director. You know, God, why are we praying for her? It's never going to happen. She is never going to quit. And then one day I did. See, friends, I'm standing in front of you today as a testament to the power of conversion. No one is beyond the power of conversion because no one is beyond the power of Christ. And I didn't know what I was going to be doing in this pro-life movement or how God was going to change my life. But about 4 years ago, as I said in my bio, I started an organization to get abortion clinic workers out of the abortion industry. And that reminded me I actually needed to update my bio because it said that we have helped 150 workers leave the abortion industry, but we have actually helped 337. And what we didn't expect actually, because ye have little faith, was that abortion doctors would begin coming to us. And so, we have also helped 7 full-time abortion doctors leave their job. And besides my children and my husband, I have to say, doing that work, helping these people, brings me the greatest joy in my life. Because there is nothing more burdensome than living with the knowledge that you have helped in the lives of innocent people. And so to be on the phone with a worker the day that they're walking out of their clinic, there's just nothing better than that. Because they are experiencing, maybe for the first time in their lives, true freedom. And it is beautiful to see how God can truly work good in the face of the most evil. And so we're about to do Q&A, but tonight, you know, I'm here to challenge you. And I know that all of you are pro-life people and you're active, but sometimes I think it's easy for us to become weary because this is a hard fight. It's a long fight. And I am always excited to hear about pro-life legislative efforts, and I do a lot of pro-life work and a lot of pro-life legislative efforts across the country, and particularly in my state of Texas. But guys, I just want to be clear. Our goal should not be to make abortion illegal. That we might do that along the way, and I hope that we do. But our end goal, friends, should be to make abortion unthinkable. And we can do that, but it's going to take every single one of us. I can't do it on my own. Cleveland Rights Life can't do it on their own. The Ohio, whatever that's called, your new thing. They can't do it on their own. It's going to take all of us. And if you're not involved, if you haven't found your place in this movement, now is the time. Whether it's getting involved in pro-life policy, whether it's standing out front of abortion facilities praying, whether it's volunteering for your local pregnancy resource center. I don't know what it is. I don't know how God's calling you to work in this movement, but I know that he's calling you to do something. And my challenge to you tonight is just to be better than me. To be better than I was. Because when I had the opportunity to do something, I stood there and did nothing. And tonight, you've been presented with the crisis. You have been presented with the tragedy. Do something about it. Act. Be bold. Don't worry about who you offend. Who cares? I don't care. I'm not here to make friends, guys. God didn't put me on this earth to make friends. He put me on this earth to speak his truth. And truth is going to be offensive. But you speak it anyway. So now I'm going to open it up to questions. I think there's index cards.
First off, I'm just stunned by, one, how witty and how touching. And
yeah, we didn't even need you.
I know, you're right. I'm purely here for tomorrow night.
I'm totally kidding.
Well, there's Satan right there. All right. Yeah, I'm going to pray for your children. All right, here we go. All right, so.
Pray for my husband.
So when this person read Unplanned, it seemed like the prayer warriors were nice. I apologize for that. To you, brought you flowers, etc. But how did they show you the truth? That's the question. How do they allow you to know that they were there for you if you ever found the truth?
Well, you know, yes, they were kind, and they were always very friendly to me, but they also were not scared to speak the truth to me and to challenge me. But that came after we had already developed a relationship. So, you know, I developed relationships with quite a few of the people who were outside of my facility. And yes, they brought me flowers and they were always very nice. And we developed a rapport. And then after that relationship had been developed, they began to challenge me on why I believed what I believed. And they ask a lot of questions, and that's really the best thing that we can do. If we come across someone who, you know, says that they're pro-choice, the best thing we can do is not to just nail them with arguments of why we're right, right? But the best thing that we can do is to ask questions, to find out how they got to the place in their life and how they got to that belief system. Because almost everybody I know who supports abortion has a story. And I can't remember what saint said it, but some saint said, I'll have to Wikipedia it, said, win an argument, lose a soul. And I'm not just about being right. I'm trying to win people over through the gospel of Christ and the gospel of life. And so it's more important for me to develop rapport and to develop a dialogue with someone who disagrees with me than to beat them over the head with arguments one after the other. So, but we want to speak truth into their lives, but we want to do it charitably. And that's what we do. And then there were none. And it's working. And we see it working all across the country.
Couple more. Do you have any statistics, estimates at least, on what percentage of all abortions are done on African American women?
Yeah, so almost there today in this country, there are almost as many African American babies aborted as there are being born. About 79% of abortion facilities are put in minority neighborhoods that are predominantly African American neighborhoods. So we see at the African American population is almost at a non-replacement rate, where their population will continue to decline because the birth rate is so low. And so that was Margaret Sanger's dream. That was her goal, and we're now seeing that come to fruition. And you know, this crowd is super white, and that's how it is most of the time when I go and speak. And I think that we need to do a better job of dialoguing with our minority brothers and sisters and helping them understand how this issue is affecting their population. I was walking around Austin one day, and this African American man came up to me, and he was volunteering with Planned Parenthood, and but they're paid volunteers. So I'm not sure that makes them a volunteer. But anyway, he was trying to get people to support Planned Parenthood and to sign a petition or support thing for Planned Parenthood. And I began speaking to him, and I said, oh, I would love to hear what you have to say about Planned Parenthood. And so he started talking to me, and so I said, you know, do you know who founded Planned Parenthood? Do you know the reason Planned Parenthood was founded? And he said no. And so I started giving him some history and some direct quotes from Margaret Sanger, things that she said about the African American population. And he gets so mad, not at me, but he gets so mad because he feels really duped, right? So he like takes his clipboard and throws it on the ground, yells an expletive, and walks off and was done. But it was because he didn't know. You know, a lot of our population, they don't know. A lot of people don't even know that Planned Parenthood is an abortion facility. ADF did Alliance Defending Freedom did a survey a few years ago and found that 50% of Americans don't even know that Planned Parenthood performs abortions, yet they are our largest abortion provider in the country. And so education is key. And so we've got to know our stuff. We've got to know what we're talking about. We need to know the history of Planned Parenthood. We have to know why it was founded, and we have to share it with people whenever we encounter them.
And I think possibly he also walked away because you're super white, not just regular white.
I'm so real white.
Could be that.
Super white.
I want to see the low. So how can we best change the view of the young generation, especially college? How can we get them to listen and to learn? Because there's an onslaught.
There are. So I tell people wherever vulnerable women are, so is Planned Parenthood. And there are tens of thousands of vulnerable women on college campuses across this country, and you better believe Planned Parenthood is there. And so we have to counter that with information. We need to support groups like Students for Life and other youth organizations that are out there on college campuses, really tackling this problem. But you know what's interesting? I find that the millennials that I go around and talk to, they're not necessarily pro-life. They're sort of indifferent on abortion. And that's great because that means they haven't really taken a side either way. And so if we present them with facts and we present them with scientific arguments and we present them with, medical ethics and we talk to them about when life begins, I find that they tend to be pretty receptive and pretty open to that. Doesn't mean they're going to go join you in the next life chain, but, you're planting seeds in the minds and the lives of these young people. And that's important. And, and the other thing that's really cool is, there was, I can't remember who did this study. There's a study done and it found that like 30% of millennials are now rejecting contraception, and they're not rejecting it because of, moral issues, but they're rejecting it because it looks real dumb buying free range chicken and popping a hormonal birth control pill every day. I'm not going to get into a big contraception talk, but I'm not going to do that. But that's hopeful to me that they're really starting to take awareness, starting to look at their bodies and how, they've been sold a bill of goods that, you need contraception because your body is broken. Basically, and so, but in reality, if they need contraception, then their body's working perfectly fine, probably. So, contraception is the only thing I can think of where it'd be like somebody going in and going, "Hey, doc, I've got a perfectly good heart. Can you give me a pill to break it?" That doesn't make any sense, right? These women's fertility, it's working perfectly fine. And they go into a doctor and say, "Everything's working good. I can get pregnant. Things are happening the way they should be. I want to break that." And so they're finally starting to, I think, get that disconnect. And they're finally starting to come around to more of an awareness of their bodies and how things work. And that's hopeful for me because then we can begin talking to them about their fertility. And we can start talking to them about changes, lifestyle changes that they can make. Because, guys, this is not just about meeting a woman when she's in crisis. That can't be what we're only about in the pro-life movement. We've got to make relationships with women before the crisis pregnancy exists. That's the best way to reduce the abortion number, is to prevent the crisis pregnancy and to help educate these women on their bodies. And so that's why I love the work that pregnancy centers are doing. It's so vital because they are attempting to develop relationships with these young women to help them make better and more healthy lifestyle choices. And I think that we have sort of a fertile ground here, with our young people, with millennials. And so it's not up to you to change anybody's mind. The Holy Spirit will do that, but it is up to us to continue to plant those seeds and, to speak truth into their lives and to be compassionate and charitable when we do it.
We've got one more question, and that was, how hard was it for you to go public? What was it like for you to become a witness?
Well, I didn't have much of a choice, because Planned Parenthood sued me, because I guess they think it's illegal to become pro-life. It's not, but, just to clarify, when they took me to court, they sent out a press release to the AP, stating that I had quit and that they were taking me to court. And that piqued the interest of the media. And so I went to court, and the next day I was on the Mike Huckabee Show. And it was difficult. It was difficult because I did all of my healing in public. And I screwed up a lot. and I said dumb things on microphones. And I was trying to figure out what I believed because I had made this huge jump and I didn't have any time to just sit and be quiet and think about the change that I had made. And so, it was hard and I was very alone in doing it because there weren't a lot of other people like me who had left, who I could talk to and say, you know, I remember one day I was talking, to Sean Carney, some of you know him, and I was telling a story about something that had happened in the clinic, and for me it was just very mundane. It was just something that happened all the time at the clinic, and I remember sharing this with him and him looking at me, and he was like, his face, he was just like horrified, and he said, "You can never tell that story to anybody else." And I thought, oh gosh, like I felt like there were a lot of things that I needed to share in order to be able to really heal. And I couldn't do it because nobody else understood what I was talking about or what I was going through. And so that was another reason that really prompted me to start, and then there were none. And I think that's one of the most effective things that we do, is we bring people who have shared experiences, who have walked down that same journey, we bring them together so that they can talk in a safe environment without anybody. A friend of mine who works for And Then There Were None, we do these healing retreats with our abortion workers and our former abortion workers. And there was this woman who was talking about, we talk a lot about things that sort of, you know, bring up memories and may cause anxiety in us. And she was talking about, how, I can't remember what it was, but it was something, it was like a bag or something that she had heard. And it reminded her of what it sounded like when the doctor would crush the skull of the baby during an abortion. And my friend was sitting there who's never worked in the abortion industry. And she, when we were done, you know, it was her first time to go to a retreat. And I said, "Well, what did you think?" And she said, the most moving part for me was when this woman was talking about crushing the skull of a baby. Nobody gasped. Nobody went, "Oh my gosh." Everybody just looked at her and shook their head because they understood. And so I think that's one of the best things that we bring to people, is really a camaraderie and a sense of shared hurt and a sense of shared healing. But I'm thankful for what I do. I'm honored to do it. I love doing it. I love being with all of you, and I love kicking Planned Parenthood's butt. So I want you guys to leave here feeling encouraged. People come to me and they say, "I don't know, Abby, I don't know if we're ever going to win. They've got Bill Clinton and Bill Gates and stacks of bills." But you know what? In the end, it really doesn't matter how much money they have or who they have on their side, because we have the number one advocate on our side, and that's Jesus Christ, and we will win this battle. Thank you all so much.
Please join me in thanking Abby.
You've been listening to Abby Johnson, the founder of And Then There Were None. Abby was the keynote speaker at our 2017 Bringing America Back to Life convention.